Okay, great. Stephanie, you've been very active in promoting and expanding environmental education programs. Do you see that as a way to attract more students into STEM fields? And if so, how does that process work and what has been successful?
Well, largely, it's what we were just talking about. One of the things that we've done, just to go back to what was just said, is that we have a program to provide internship funds for minority students, and we found that if you support the B students, it's just transformative what can happen to them. So they come in to Barnard, you know, obviously academically prepared, but then for some reason they're not achieving at the level that they could. And if you give them the research opportunity, and I think that this is really critical, that was one element that was just talked about, they become engaged in the research. They start interacting with it in a personal way, and they're able to drive it. They're able to sort of shine in ways outside of the classroom. And that can really have a major impact on their future career. So I think that that's one thing that can be replicated elsewhere, and it's not such a high, you know, cost as having this overarching, you know, all of the other elements of the program, which sound to be really exciting. Turning to the environment, I really see the environment, you know, of course I'm involved in this field, but it's kind of the liberal science field of the century, I think, because you bring together all of the different disciplines in environment, and you also have a sort of problem-oriented or problem-solving focus that makes them naturally work together. So you see the need for the different disciplines as well. And what I think this does for students is it makes this link to their own lives, which research has shown that many students resonate with. But then they're also allowed to pursue their area and their interests in greater depth. And I think that that is attractive to a lot of students. The ones that it's not attractive to, and this is interesting, are ones that maybe have pressure from home or their own pressure to really know what their career trajectory is going to be at the other end. Because the field is so open right now and there are so many different possibilities, it's, you know, you're not clearly oriented toward any one of those. And so that's a challenge that we have as advisors.
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up a good point, and again, this is for everyone to comment if they'd like. How career-oriented are your students, and how career-oriented should they be? Would you like them to have an idea when they start the major of what they're going to do with that, what their career possibilities are? And if so, can you make use of that, or are you looking for a broader you know, type of training, which they will then apply later on?
What we, just to clarify, what we do in our program is we try to give them the skills and sort of the approaches that will let them be successful, you know, no matter what they do. So it's not that we're saying we're training you all to be graduate students afterwards. We're saying data analysis is something that you need to know if you're balancing your own checkbook as well as, you know, in your career as an environmental economist or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that this idea of teaching students how to teach themselves, and also that if helping them become engaged in depth in one topic so that they see just how much they can learn, and then they can translate that to other topics.
I'd say that nature doesn't give us the great problems of the world packaged up with labels that say physics or chemistry or this or that. And so we want the students to really have that broad background that prepares them of the sort that I was talking about in the core program at Harvey Mudd, for example. But having an in-depth experience is useful, too. And I would say that as much as the students may or may not be thinking about careers, we should be thinking about careers. That the nature of careers in the sciences in the United States, the way that the profession unrolls in the experience of a student, is something that we should really pay more attention to. Because the opportunity cost for a good student in the United States to go into a career in science is very different, a very different calculation than it might be for someone in India or China in the developing world. And so we shouldn't be surprised that students think about going to professional schools, business school, law school, or something else like that, if we don't really pay attention to making these rewarding and fulfilling kinds of careers. And I'm not just talking about money, but rewarding and fulfilling types of careers where you can really get involved in creative work, say, without having to be a postdoc for 10 years. First.
Mm-hmm. Michael, how career-oriented out of the UMBC students, and does that push them into or out of STEM fields, in your experience?
Well, our campus has a science and technology focus, and so many of them do come with those interests. But let me just say, in that regard, I think the U.S. really is doing it right. I mean, we do have some students that have known since kindergarten that they wanted to be an MD, and that's fine. I don't know where some of those pressures come from. I mean, certainly many of the students have, especially some of our minority students, have been told from the earliest days, you know, if you work hard in school, you can be a doctor. And so some of them do have that goal. But in general, I think we need to be careful about pushing careers at too early a stage. I know from discussions with my international graduate students that at a very early age in some countries, children are tested and then tracked as either science or non-science. And I think it would be an enormous mistake to do those kinds of things here. I think it's good that students start college with somewhat of an open mind and can get really turned on by one teacher or one subject or other.
The issue of accountability has become a buzzword in K through 12 education. Last year, a federal commission suggested the concept be applied to higher education as well. How well are U.S. institutions doing in tracking how their students perform while they're in college, publicizing what happens to them after graduation, and other issues relating to STEM education? All of you want to take a crack at that?
I'll try to start. I don't know that there is any real tracking that goes on with our general student population once they leave. We certainly do track students that are involved in our program. So the students that are part of the Meyerhoff Scholars Program, we know where they are in grad school. We know where they are in their postdocs. And those that are starting to look for faculty positions, we know where they are. And we keep in close touch with them because we do want to document whether these extra efforts that do cost money whether we're being successful or not. I think it's a real problem. You know, most people in academics are scientists, or at least in the STEM areas. I mean, most of us don't just teach; we also have some research. And in our research, we're always evaluated based on our performance. If we write an NIH grant or an NSF grant, we have certain objectives that we'll try to meet. And in 3 or 4 years, our peers look at those and say, "Have you met those objectives or not? Have you been successful?" And we define what those metrics are when we write our proposal. Well, a major part of our job is to teach and to educate and of course, to retain. But I don't know that we ever take that same scientific approach in our teaching. And this isn't something that I'm saying should be mandated from the top, but I'm just saying as scientists, we should approach teaching the way we approach our science, which is to think about what's important. It's the performance of the students, and are they excited about the area? I mean, these are our areas. I mean, if we're not retaining students in our own areas, we're not doing our areas any real service.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, what do you think accountability should mean at Barnard and for STEM education?
Well, one of the things that we do is track our majors. You know, we want to find out where they are and what they're doing. We bring them back on campus and have them talk about, you know, their current career as well as their experience as a student at Barnard, and we've done that increasingly for a number of different reasons. One is that we do want to find out, you know, what they're up to and what the major opportunities are, so that we can let our own students know. But one thing we haven't done, which I think that we should, is to maybe ask them to be reflective on about their experience. You know, what was it that made them decide to go on in this track, or what was it that was particularly valuable? We do a sort of an exit survey, you know, when they leave. But I think this perspective a couple years out would be really valuable to get. We do it once in a while when you do, you know, sort of a program review, but it might be useful to do it in between as well. But what I think is really exciting right now is this idea of trying to understand better what students are learning in your classes. And we've started at Barnard with the help from the Consortium for High Achievement and Success. This is an organization that is interested in understanding why especially minority students may come in with high SATs, but they then tend to underperform, especially in the large introductory classes, not just in the sciences, but in other disciplines as well. And so we've been running a forum for faculty, and we have brought in some people who taught us basically that there are other assessment tools other than a standard trying to get students to repeat that content that they learned in the class. And so they have these very interesting approaches. And one is, if you want to understand, do the students understand the system, you have them come up with a flow chart or a concept map, or you ask them to put together a timeline of the evolution of events, rather than just answering, say, an essay or even a multiple choice question. But what they've also asked us to do, to think about, is a more reflective part during the course as it moves along. And so I've done this on the essays that I have the students write. I ask them to reflect at the end about the process and their personal experience of writing the essay. And it's amazing what comes out of that, where I really understand more what the student intent was, and I'm much better able to evaluate their final result. And we're also doing that in this environmental measurements class that we're teaching, that we have support from the National Science Foundation to take students out on the Hudson River and actually take samples from the river and then analyze them afterwards. And in that case, too, we now have a biweekly or so reflective piece, and that's really helped the instructors to understand where they're meeting their goals and where they need to have some more attention.
Mm-hmm. Now, everyone has talked about, you know, how students learn and, as you said, incorporating that into the curriculum. Let me ask you about teacher training specifically. School districts across the country can't find enough well-trained science and math teachers, and many people feel universities have contributed to the problem by steering their best STEM students into research careers and neglecting those with an interest in teaching. Why has higher education been slow to respond to this crisis, or if it has, and what are your institutions doing to address that problem?
I don't think that we've been so slow. I think the momentum has really been growing around this problem, that is to address the need for really terrific and inspiring science and math educators throughout the system. And I can give a few examples. We started a master's degree program in mathematics for teaching at Harvard that had hundreds of Boston public school teachers coming in and taking courses taught by people in the mathematics department. There's Math for America, something that Harvey Mudd College is getting involved with. There are lots and lots of different initiatives that are going on, and there's an increasing recognition, I think, as Stephanie was pointing out, that the more that you can help people understand and think about what's going on in the kids' minds and how they are relating to and building their own understanding, that's just very powerful and very exciting. I mean, it can also be a real kick to see that someone has this misconception, but here you can do this and that and fix it, and then everybody smiles and goes on and builds from there. So that that kind of enjoyment and fulfillment, the gratification that you can get from that, is something that's worth emphasizing. It's not simply a matter of putting more money into the salaries for teachers. It's not just a matter of even simply giving them the content knowledge. All of those things are important, but it's also learning how to use that content knowledge. There's something a little different that you need to know and understand to be a very good teacher. It's a little different from just what you need to know and understand to be, say, a good researcher or a mathematician or scientist. And we're beginning to have a better idea of what that's all about and how to do it, and I think it's very encouraging.
Do you think that there was always that latent interest among your undergraduates, or has their perception of the teaching profession changed in recent years? Is it more attractive? Is Teach for Math, Teach for America, these master's programs that are attracting people, offering something that is more seen as more interesting than it used to be?
So I have to say that I run into students all the time at the very best institutions who are passionate about teaching their subjects and who would love to make a career teaching high school, teaching K-12, teaching at the college level, and who really find it difficult sometimes to wrap their heads around what a career like that would look like. So again, I think that we need to take some responsibility and really think about how these labor markets work, how the profession unfolds, and in particular, the kinds of communities that exist to support that. In many countries, to be a member of the profession of a teacher is a very honorable and very community-based kind of an activity where teachers are getting together all the time and exchanging insights and working to perfect and to improve their craft and their art. And that happens rather little in the United States, and I think that that's really too bad. I see places, the lesson study movement, for example, where there's more of that happening, and it draws these students in, or Math for America, Teach for America, where you feel like you're part of a community, where you have that support, where you could see how your career could unfold so that you make progress, that you make a contribution, so that you grow and can become a leader eventually. If you see that kind of a progression, then I think there are many, many students out there who would be thrilled to devote themselves to that very important work.
Michael, what about the Meyerhoff program in UMBC? Is teaching secondary school considered a goal, a success, or is the program more oriented toward graduate training and research careers?
Well, I think there's some tension there, and probably there's tension in any chemistry department about this, because we're trying to encourage our students to get excited about discovery and excited about research and to be passionate about it. Science in general, which involves doing experiments. And so on the one hand, you know, we brag about our students that go to graduate school at Harvard, right? It's tough because if you, on the one hand, you're trying to get your best students to get excited about science and get into the lab and do research. Okay, so the student gets into the lab, they get excited about research. Now, are there going to be opportunities to do those kinds of things when they go into teaching in the K-12 area? Probably not. They're probably going to have huge teaching loads. And, you know, as Danny said, there are right now it's not a glamorous profession. It's not a well-paid profession. So so then there's this other tension. Do you want to train scientists to be teachers, or do you train people in education enough about science so that they can teach the science curriculum? And, you know, being in a science department, we think, well, you should be a scientist to train a scientist. So I don't see that there are any real easy answers right now. I think that, you know, we struggle with that ourselves. Now, we're partnering with the education department to come up with programs so that the students that we see that are interested in teaching in K-12 have the right kind of education, and we provide the right connections and opportunities for them. And so we're working on this area, but I'd be dishonest if I said we had an obvious answer.
Can I just add that distinction that Mike was drawing between the scientists and the teachers, that doesn't exist in every country. And there's a long tradition in Europe, say, of gymnasium teachers moving back and forth from teaching the advanced high school and being in a university or college. And in fact, their training programs are really quite similar. They're in the same departments. And Grassmann, for example, is a famous mathematician who was a gymnasium teacher. So was Weierstrass. And they're considered part of the professional community in that college. And many of them are both doing important research and doing the teaching. And so I don't think it's impossible to find ways for people to have satisfying careers that incorporate both.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Thank you. We're working on both ends of this problem. So as Danny said, it's really important to ease the fledgling teachers into what is going to become, you know, it can swamp them if they don't have this transition. And we have a really great education program that teaches them the fundamentals of teaching, then helps walk them through student teaching in schools in Harlem with former Barnard students who are now teaching there. So they get this whole, again, as we've talked about before, they have this whole community that surrounds the effort. And that program is working really well. But at the other end, what we also are doing is offering research opportunities to teachers, both through Barnard and Columbia University. And that's very exciting because many of these teachers have been feeling a little isolated, maybe as one of the only scientists in their school. And to get them back engaged in research gets them so excited about it, and then they bring that excitement and those new discoveries back into the classroom.
And so I think that that really helps as well to sort of maintain their interests and also to advance both their own experience, but then, you know, show the students that there's this higher level that they can aspire to.
Mm-hmm. Right. Research opportunities for undergraduates is a theme I think that all of you are involved in, has been shown to be successful, as well as the bringing the professionals back. Danny, I wondered if you could talk about a program at Harvard Mudd that involves students in real-life research problems through partnerships with industry, and how that those projects are developed, how it fits into their overall education, and why it's been successful.
Sure, Jeff. All of the students at Harvey Mudd College have a chance to participate in undergraduate research or in a specially structured clinic program, or in both for that matter. And the clinic is really a signature program at Harvey Mudd. It was developed more than 40 years ago there, and it does partner, as you say, teams of students with industry, and not just industry, but also of the federal laboratories and venture capitalists, sometimes foundations and so on, but people who have real problems that they don't know the answer to and they really need and want the answer to. And so the importance of having a client like that and a technical liaison who you're conferring with constantly in a very professional, business-like manner every week really makes a big difference. And we organize these clinics with a flat fee to the sponsor. We give them all the intellectual property rights because we're really interested in picking problems that are going to be very, very good educational experiences for our students, and that's our priority. And so, for example, we've had students who are developing, helping Boeing to develop the next GPS system. We've had lots of biomedical programs, including some that have very critical applications in Iraq these days. There are venture capitalists who have us working on solar chimneys, trying to solve the energy problems of the world. The FAA has us helping to land airplanes and all kinds of sustainability work. You get the idea. There's a lot of exciting things that the students can get involved with. And the upshot is that we've had students' names on 13 patent disclosures in 1 year. And these are significant results that get patented, they get published in peer-reviewed journals, they get talked about by undergraduates at professional meetings. And we've even taken this clinical program in the last year or two and turned it global. By working with multinationals who have facilities in other countries, we team up with university and university students there, exchange places during the summer to get to know one another, and then work during the year on these problems the way people work in the world today, which is to say a lot of video conferencing, a lot of email, a lot of the kind of interactions that everybody does in this very globalized and flat world. And so what we find in this is that it not only charges people up and gets them ready to work in a way that the employers and the graduate schools both really appreciate, but it also brings to the fore some of the strengths of the students that they might not have noticed before. And many of the students who might not be, as Stephanie was saying before, the ones who you would predict to be A students or who have the highest scores coming in necessarily, really make tremendous contributions when they're put into these kinds of situations where they have to manage and work as a team and come up with creative solutions. And so I think that that's a place where we have a tremendous advantage in having small schools and having these small communities over, say, what could possibly go on at the scale of India or China. We get carried away with the body counts there and with the numbers there, but they cannot give this kind of attention to finding the student who may not on paper look like the most creative and passionate or accomplished person, but who has an amazing creativity and passion to contribute. And putting them into these kinds of situations where they have a compelling question, where they have the ability to contribute, really makes a difference. And it's just a great pleasure to see these students bloom and to see them absolutely eager about going on in their careers.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you make sure that it remains an educational experience and that these students don't just become a pair of hands or a job shop for a company or for a national lab?
Well, as I say, we give away all the intellectual property rights, so we're not trying to make money on this. It's a flat fee, and we really spend a lot of time with the corporations or the federal laboratories, the sponsors, to really pick problems that are going to work well for undergraduates and that they can really make a contribution. And we explain to the students that sometimes even finding out that the original idea didn't work is a tremendously valuable experience for them and for the companies. We had a CEO come. We've had CEOs come and tell about how whole divisions of their corporation have been founded based on particular ideas that came from Harvey Mudd College, and they've made a fortune. And we hope that they remember us when they do. But also we've had CEOs who have come and said, you know, the idea that we had didn't work, and you investigated it very thoroughly and showed exactly why it didn't work, and you saved me millions and millions of dollars and a year or two and of putting lots of staff on this, and that was a tremendously valuable thing. And so the repeat business that we do, the number of companies that have done 25 clinics and just want to do more is really very large. People find that a satisfying experience all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Now, all of you have talked about programs aimed at special populations, including minorities and women, as part of trying to build the STEM workforce. At the same time, there's continuing pressure on institutions to eliminate such programs, which are seen by some people as discriminatory. Is this having an impact on the programs that you run, and how has your institution dealt with that outside pressure?
Well, at UMBC, we have had to worry about that a little bit. When the program was first started, the money came from a Baltimore philanthroper, Robert and Jane Meyerhoff, and it was given to us specifically for black males. And then as we raised money from other sources, it was opened up to black women and then to minorities in general. And then with the Banneker decision at College Park, which basically shut down their diversity program in the sciences, we decided to open up our program to all students who have an interest in issues of diversity in the sciences. Now, I think that's the key to making it work for us, because at other places where the scholarships were no longer just given based on background or ethnicity, they were based on merit or need, those programs at other places often became no longer were they minority programs. Minority participation was less than half in most of them. So in our case, it's a merit-based program. So if a student qualifies for it and they're a white student, you have to decide, do you really want to do all of the outreach and all of the activities that are involved in this program? I mean, these students have to serve as tutors to inner-city minority students in the high schools and in the K-12 system, and they have other monthly activities that they have to be involved in. If they can take a scholarship, a general merit scholarship, and do that, or they could take the Meyerhoff scholarship. So the majority students that enroll in the Meyerhoff program do so because there is a genuine interest in these issues, and we want people like that in this program, so that we can have majority students going to graduate school and talking about, issues of diversity and understanding what the issues really are.
So you feel that you've been able to maintain the focus of the program even after opening it up to a general population?
Oh, yeah. It was opened up many years ago, and mm-hmm. right now I think it's about 12% Caucasian and about 12 to 15% Asian students, and the rest are minority students.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, what about the programs at Barnard?
Right. We are a women's college, and so, we can open it up to all our students, and we've got a large number of women involved in them. But I am doing some work on advancing women faculty through promotions and tenures and through a grant from the National Science Foundation. And one of the things that we've done through that, actually, is when we've done the research on what it would take to actually be a real assistance to women, the programs are ones that would also be of assistance to men. usually. And so what we've done is we've opened up the programs to everyone, and more women tend to seek them out, but that's great if men are involved as well. So it's one of these things that when you identify something for one population, you realize, well, actually, this would be wonderful to be able to open it up and offer this to other people, because you've sort of seen this unmet need by focusing in on one area, but then you can extend it to others.